Not only that, I mean, if he has a desire to die, that's wrong. I mean, God's will is that you should live. The fact is that you're living, so it's God's will that you should live. Why is it like going God's will against God's will too? Saying, look, take my life. Just one point, and that is that he wouldn't take his life. A suicidal person would take his own life. But here he asks God to take his life. I mean, definitely, halachically, he's not over, he's not going against halacha, you say. But the thing is he is, it's the attitude that he is asking God to take his life. And the question is, why? I mean, he should want to live, to do mitzvahs. In fact, David HaMelech, in one of his tefillos, according to the Meiri, when he's very sick, David HaMelech was very sick, and he prays to God to let him live. So the Meiri says, not because he's afraid of dying, you know what I mean, like a fear of death. He says, but he wants more time to perfect the soul. He needs more time to perfect the soul. So if that is true, and he should also want to see if he gained more knowledge of God. You understand? So the question is that that why should he ask God to want to die? The question is that since I mentioned before that since we're alive, so it must be God's will that we're alive, right? The answer is, because anything that, so the question is, how do we know that? The answer is that because the thing is, nothing happens in this world without God's will. Everything that's here is God's will. So if I'm alive, it must be God's will. And when it's his will that he doesn't want me to be alive, so I'll die. You understand? But as long as I'm alive, it's God's will, and I don't have a right to go against God's will. That's a philosophical, I think that's a philosophical reason why you shouldn't commit suicide. The question is, since let's say, for instance, like by Eliyahu, there was a contract out by Izebel on his life. So he says, since there's a contract out on my life, maybe that's God's will too, that I should that contract should be out of my on my life. Same question. You know what I mean? Like if everything is God's will, so but for, there's a kind of anything that happens, it should be that should be God's will. Like, for instance, Chinese, they don't give charity. Why? Because if somebody's poor, they say that's God's will that he should be poor. So therefore, they don't bother giving charity, because that's God's will. The question is that if I shoot somebody, so if everything is in God's will, so whether the guy will die or not is whether the bullet will hit him is in God's will. You understand? So everything is in God's will. Okay. The first thing, there's one other question that we have to ask. One other question. And that is like this. God's will is that we should have free will. And God's will is that we should do the good. Right? The question is, how could these two, God's will, exist simultaneously? Because free will dictates that I could do good or evil. And then God's will is that I should do good. So therefore, the question is, which one is God's will? Robert wants to say like this, that there are two things. There is what God created the world and how he made the world. That's one will. Like, for instance, free will. God created free will. Okay? But, however, he's telling the human that you have free will, but you should choose, it is my will that you should choose the good. In other words, that's how you should work out your life. You have the free will. You could do either way. You have the right to do either way. That's what I've created. But now the question is, you have to make decisions. Since you have free will, you now have to make decisions. And since you have to make decisions, I am telling you, my will is not that you have to live by my will, because you could do the opposite. But if you want to be successful in my world, then my will is that that's the way you should make decisions. Not that it, in other words, like this. One is like a decree. I have decreed that the physical world should exist, and God decreed that you should have free will. God decreed it. That must happen. Whether you're going to live or die, that God decrees. That's not in your hands, you see. But however, what you choose, God says, this is, it's not a decree. This is what I want. This is what's best for you. This is what's going to make the world work perfectly. My system will work perfectly, and you'll have a good life, and it'll be good for you. But however, it's still, but the decree is a free will. The decree is free will. But however, then God tells you what you, how you should live your life. That the best life in the system that I have created is if you choose the good. The problem is that it's God's will that you should do the good. So we're grappling with the difference between God's will, which aren't subdivided, God's will. So insofar as the creation of free will, that's a decree. Decree means that that just like God created the laws of nature, that stays. There's no, you can't, that's it, nobody can change the laws of nature. However, it's God's will that you should choose the good, but it's not God's decree that you will choose the good. You see? It's not a decree. So the question is, what is it? I think we have a good description of it. I think we're just looking for the right word to explain God's will, that that God's will is here that you should choose the good, but it's not a decree of God that that you will choose the good, like he decreed the laws of nature. In other words, you see millions of people that they choose evil. They go against, they seem to be going against God's will, which seems to be an impossibility. So you have to say, there's what God says, what is the nature? That's it, there's no change in that, that every human being has free will, that the law of gravity, whatever law is, that is a law of nature. That can't be changed. So there's a law of nature that you have free will. Now, but God's will is that you should choose the good. So you have to subdivide between the way you look at his will. One is like a decree which must happen, and one is God is saying that it's my will that you should do the good. People say, like they want to use the word preference. And the word preference means, in other words, just one question. Is that God's will? Is God's will that you should choose the good? Is that correct? That's it. I understand. That's the problem.
No, I'm saying that God's...
The other possibility was that that God's will is that you should have free will, but he's just putting you in a situation, like he gave you the Torah, that you could see the good. So the question is, why do he want you to see the good? Because it's God's will that you should choose the good. So it's still the same, you got to come back to God's will. However, all we're making a distinction is that there's a difference between where God's will is insofar as nature is concerned and where God's will is insofar as what we should do, what actions we should do. We're making just that distinction. There's a difference, but however, I think you need a definition and clarity of wherein lies the difference insofar as God's will is concerned. And so the question is, why should Eliyahu want to die? Okay, that's the question. The answer is like this: that the that he held at this point, right after this situation, God takes Eliyahu, where he takes him out to Mount Sinai, right, to show him how God operates. What do you mean, Eliyahu doesn't know how God operates? The answer is, there was a difference of opinion. He held that Ahav, didn't deserve tshuva. Ahav didn't deserve tshuva. He didn't deserve a chance to repent. That's it. God's mercy was that, no, he still did. In other words, there is a point, definitely according to the Rambam, there is a point where a person is not given the right to do tshuva. That's the punishment. Say that is the punishment, that you're not given a right. The machlokas, it sounds funny, but the machlokas between God and Eliyahu was, did Ahav reach that point? You see? Now, Eliyahu tried to understand this idea, but he couldn't, for some reason, I don't know, he couldn't see it. Couldn't see it. Okay? So therefore he held that he couldn't continue the mission. In other words, he saw, in other words, that the mission needed that you see the idea, that you see and understand, that, because the way you relate to Ahav and the way you carry it out is going to be a different thing. So therefore he needed to see it. And the proof of this, that he was right, that you needed to see it, because when he couldn't see it after God tried to show it, this truth to him on Har Sinai, he's told them to go appoint Elisha. You see? So even God held that if you can't see it, then you shouldn't continue. And therefore you see that after he trained Elisha, he died. So his decision to die was a correct decision. You say that was correct. He knew, in other words, Eliyahu knew that that if he did not, if he could not see that Ahav could have, that Ahav could have more mercy, and he should give, be given a chance to do tshuva, he knew he couldn't take the mission. If he didn't take the mission, then somebody else had to take over the mission. Somebody else take over the mission, then he should die. You see? So therefore, he says that they take my life, because I can't do that. So God tried to help him by taking him to Har Sinai and showing him this idea. You see? Show him the idea. Then when he still couldn't see it, then he told him to point to Elisha. The question is, why does he have to die if he cannot carry out the mission? Robert wants to say there's two possibilities. One is that it has to do with the nature of Eliyahu, that maybe Eliyahu couldn't, that's it, he reached a plateau, that's it. That's as far as he could go, and since the purpose of life is to develop, and he couldn't develop. Or the other possibility is that his life, somehow his life is attached to his mission. And once the mission is over, so then his life is over. That's these are the two possibilities that Rabbi wants to do. And it makes sense. So we want to answer the question. Yesterday we said there's two possibilities. One possibility is that he perfected himself as much as he can, and therefore it's time to die. Or two, that since he couldn't carry out the mission, okay, and it has to do inherently with the mission, so therefore he wanted to die. Okay, so we want to point out that first of all, since he has to die, so he is deciding, and logically he knows that it is time to die. And you see, God granted him his wish because what happened was he didn't want to give Ahav a chance to do tshuva. Okay? And then God tries to teach him by Har Sinai. This is according to the Ralbach, that God tried to teach him at Har Sinai the idea of mercy, that he should have mercy on Achav. And he couldn't accept the idea. At that point, God tells him that he should appoint Elisha, and then once he trains Elisha, then he does. So you see that God agreed with him if he could not continue his mission. So the thing is, you see that a person reaches the point in life where the essence of his life is to do the will of God. That's his essence of life. And once he's in conflict with that mission, or when he completes the mission, or for whatever reason, he decides, I don't know what level you have to be on, but Elio decided that it was time, since he couldn't carry out the mission, and that's the nature of his existence, that's his whole existence, there's nothing else he exists for, and since God said that he must, the mission must be carried out, and he couldn't carry it out, so therefore he knew it was time for him to die, unless God could bring him out. Robert asked like this, since it is impossible for God to be wrong, so how could Eliyahu argue with God? He should just accept God's deal. There are two things. There is the halakha, where once I know how to do it, then I have to do it, whether I understand it or not. And then there's hashkafa, where either I understand it or I don't, but you can't force me to understand it. Now, since his mind thought a different way, and he understood it differently, then the only way you could get him to do that is to try to educate him. And if he can't be educated, so then you can't straighten him out. Now, why can't Elio be educated? I haven't decided to idea. Okay. Also, we said on the Rabbi Chase said on the tape that that you should be influenced. First, should be influenced through Torah, through Chachma. In other words, when Torah influences you through Chachma, and not through miracles. And he quoted the Rav as saying, they're pointing out that after Har Sinai, it was a few days after Har Sinai, that Klal Yisrael was in trouble already. We want to know what's the difference between a miracle and Chachma. Right after Har Sinai. After the, when they say, yeah, right after all these miracles, they sort of come place. You know what I mean? They were in trouble all along. The question they're asking how is it possible that a person could see all the miracles, like you see the 10 plagues and the miracles in the desert and the Har Sinai? How could they see all these things and yet not be moved to change and to do the correct thing and live in line with God? I mean, it's like it has to have an unbelievable impact. You know what I mean? Much more than learning. You know what I mean? Like, it should be much more than learning. It should be just the opposite. And yet we see the facts from the Torah. It seems to be a big problem. That it's not as successful as we seem to think, and most people think this way, that a miracle would be more successful in reaching people than Chachma, right? And yet we see from the facts that doesn't seem to be so, from the facts that we have in Torah. I mean, even in the time of Elio and Elisha, they were worshipping other Zara, and they were, I mean, it had a little impact, but, you know what I mean, but not such a great impact. You know what I mean? It affected some people, but, you know what I mean? Like, right after Mount Carmel, the guy makes, Elio makes this big miracle. Ezebel put the contract out on his life. He had to run away. I mean, the nation saw the miracle. They should have said, don't run, Elio. You stick with us. We'll stand behind you. Right? Doesn't happen. Question is why? But the question is it a societal thing? Like in those days, it didn't have such a big effect, but it's possible if we had it today, it would have a bigger effect. But the thing is, you see throughout the Torah, whenever there was a miracle, it might have been an effect right away, but then afterwards they lose it, and there was different societies, you see. In other words, you'd have to show me a society where someplace in Torah should have the case where there was a miracle and it changed their life throughout forever. You know what I mean? It seems like Yonah went out to Nineveh and he preached to them. I mean, he didn't perform any miracles, he preached to them and they did repented. That seems to have been a bigger success than all the miracles. Robert wants to compare this, that if you give a person a raise, right? A guy's complaining, he needs some more money, you give him the raise. Now that raise, the satisfaction for that raise lasts for a certain amount of time, or anything you get, you buy something new. It lasts for a certain amount of time and then it passes, and we're thinking that it's possible that could be connected to a miracle somehow. And we're still investigating. I mean, that could be connected to a miracle, and then we'd have to show how Chachma is somehow different than that. Right? Okay, that's possible. Another point about this is that people could learn. They learn a lot, and then they're nothing. Something big happens that hits you mostly powerful. Boy, whoa, you know, it's a big thing. I mean, wherein lies that Chachma is better than a miracle? Also, it was mentioned on the tape, Echad Amar v'Echad Amamet. Okay, it doesn't matter if one learns more, one learns less. He gets a chelek in olam haba, right? Okay. Now the question is, what do you mean? I mean, a person learns more, it should be greater than a person that learns less. Okay? In other words, if a person learns more and he has more knowledge, he should have a higher chelek in olam haba. His reward should even be greater. So why you say, Echad Amar v'Echad Amamet, it doesn't matter if one learns a lot, one learns a lot. There should be a difference. The answer is that what is the benefit of learning is not having knowledge. You could learn and you could be a Rasha. You understand? Has no effect on you at all. All the learning is absolutely worthless. You could be a very good Talmud Chacham. I mean, I wouldn't call him a Talmud Chacham. I'd say he's very knowledgeable in Torah, and the guy could be a total Rasha. He steals, he does terrible things. You say? A total Rasha. The answer is that learning affects your personality. You see? It changes who you are. It goes down to what motivates you to do things. When you start out in life, you have a certain motivation based on your genes and the way you were raised. Then learning changes the very motivation to what motivates you, who you are. Changes who you are. See, a miracle doesn't do that. A miracle only awakens that there is a God and he's very powerful. But it doesn't change me at all. I'm still the same person. When you get a raise, you're still the same person. People go to NCSY conventions. They come back on a high, a very high level. I've seen people go to Eretz Israel and they come back on, wow, they're really... And all of it disappears. All of it disappears. It goes down the drain. As if there was nothing. The only thing that remains is when your learning affects who you are. That is where you change in the chelek in olam haba. And that's the difference in why Chachma will keep you going in places. I mean, you see Rabbi Akiva, he reached a level where he's being tortured. It doesn't affect him. A miracle could never do that. Anything that awakens a wow, that does not change your personality. That is only to get you started. All these things are good to get you started. But the ultimate in what Torah says is chachma, because it changes who you are. That you can't change. That once you change who you are, that's who you are. You're going to live by it. A different different person. The question is, how could a person be chota, be sin? How could he sin if he just saw a miracle? Okay? Well, you take the idea of lesson hara. Okay? Let's say you go to a class and they tell you what's going to happen and all the catastrophe about talking lesson hara. Well, everything, right? You walk out of that class. Will you not talk lesson hara? Yeah, maybe mostly. But the next day, it's all over with. You understand? Because it's not you. It only awakens in you that I now have to start changing who I am and not talk lesson hara. Even if you desire the truth, even if you desire to do all the mitzvahs, is a miracle or something happened that changed, you're still who you are. And now the development of Torah through Chachma is to change who you are. And that's really the benefit of Chachma. That's why it doesn't matter if you learn all of Shas, half of Shas, you learn one line. The main thing is how much it's real to you, how much it affects you. That is the part of Torah that takes you to Olam Haba. That is the part of Torah that changes who you are. That is the part of Torah that's the part of the learning of Torah that changes you. That's a real bad change. And a miracle doesn't change you. You're still the same person. It only tells you a fact. It only tells you a new fact. You know what I mean? Like it awakens that fact and it awakens certain emotions. But however, it doesn't change who you are. Still the same old person. The thing is like this. Let's say, for instance, something exciting happens. Your emotion is awakened, right? But it passes. No matter what it is, you cannot maintain that emotion. Now, you buy a new house. You're very excited. But you cannot maintain that emotion. Same thing with a miracle. You can't maintain it because it's an outside circumstance affecting a part of your personality that brings it out. That brings out that part of your personality. You see? But that's it. You can't maintain it. It's not who you are. Who you are is what motivates you, not which emotion is awakened every once in a while by circumstance. But who you are is your personality, what motivates you. What drives you, how you make decisions in life, your personality and that, or whatever becomes second nature through Chachma. That's who you are. That's not a circumstantial thing. That's essentially who you are. When you see a miracle, it's a circumstantial event that brings out there really is a God. But it's only circumstantial, it's not who you are. Then you go back to the old way. The only way to change your personality is through Chachma. Even if you want to, let's say you go for analysis. What is analysis? It changes slowly your view of yourself, who you are. You think you're one type of person, and then through analysis, we show you that you're another type of person. You're something beneath the surface, that you're really something else. So again, it's Chachma that changes you. It's not a one-time thing. It's where you see the idea, and the idea affects you, and it just slowly but surely changes who you are. Don't want to say also another proof of this, is that when they had the Makos, Makos lasted approximately a week, unless it was cut short by Parah. The power wanted it because it was too strong. And then they didn't have another Maka for a month. Why?
because they had the time, they needed time to investigate and digest it and understand it. He's thinking it through the chachma after the miracle that's going to affect you. The thought and working it through. But the miracle itself is a circumstance that affects you emotionally, just a circumstance. But it's not, doesn't change who you are. The investigation afterwards that could change who you are. And even in receiving you with that body stuff, that didn't work. I mean, you feel it does not work. But the real truth is that's where it's supposed to work. If you think about it afterwards. I don't want to say that the difference between why, even though after they worked on it, they thought about it, but it didn't affect. In other words, you have to say that it didn't affect them, even though they went through it. But they were attached to the wow of the miracle. They were, because their emotions were attached to the wow of the miracle. So when they learned about it, they learned about it in that framework of the wow and the miracle, and they couldn't make the change from the wow of the miracle to the chachma that comes after. If that's a possible. The possible explanation. Very good. That is the real benefit of Torah. The real benefit of Torah is it changes who you are. It's not just a momentary thing. You know what I mean? You get something, you get a new house, a new car, you know what I mean? All these things are just circumstances for the moment. And you have to keep getting things to keep you going. You need the physical world to keep you going. But chachma, it's the chachma is that when it affects your personality, that's permanent. But if it changes who you are, so if you're happy with that, that is a permanent type of change in you. One of the things that Rabbi Chaim said on the tape is that the difficulty of performing a miracle is that a miracle must go through a human. And the problem is, if it goes through the human, then people could attach the miracle to his power. Okay? That it's not through God, but it's his power. Right? We'd like to understand how that works. The question that we're dealing with is how does it work that the person will attach, that people will attach the miracle to the person who is performing, is through him is the miracle being performed. You also find the same thing by the Kohen. The Kohen does the blessing, right? So the thing is, people could believe that the Kohen has powers, right? Like to understand how that works. In other words, what's the question is, what's the mechanism that makes you think that it came through the person and not God?
Okay.
What's that mechanism? Okay. The first step is that superficially you don't see God doing anything, right? But you see an act that a man is like Moshe hit the water, okay? Or whatever the man is, or Yeshua said, let the sun stop. So what the public sees is a superficial, the physical. But they perceive with their five senses. Okay? Now the question is, so then why do they say that it comes through him and not God? All right, so that's the first step. The public perceives it with their five senses, so it's superficial. Okay, question is, what happens after that? All right, so what we want to say first is that they see Moshe hitting the water, so they say that he has the power, because that's all they see, okay? But even with all this, what we just said, that you see the man doing the act, then the miracle occurs, so you say cause and effect, right? But the only thing is, we're talking about people that know God. They do know God, you see. Now the question is, we were talking about people that, like, let's say, by the splitting of the sea, right? Now, these people were there by the 10 plagues. See, they knew it was God. How could they say cause and effect that it is Moshe? You see? That's the question. The answer is like this. There are two ways of interpreting the physical world. That is from the facts, and you interpret the facts. And two is that you project certain feelings that you have onto the physical world. Okay? Those are the only two ways of interpreting the physical world. Okay? Question is in other words, now there are two things. There is something in the, and so in other words, when you look at the physical world, you can interpret one of two ways, okay? Now, sometimes, in other words, now if you're going to interpret something based on your feelings, you see, it can only be where the information is not clear. Like, for instance, child is frightened of a monster. If they have a light on in the room, then they will never say that there's a monster in the room. But the monster is under the bed or in the closet. It's some place that you cannot see. But that which you can see, so there you can never say there's a monster. You see? Now the same thing, when the mind is clear on an idea, and there is no doubt about the idea, so then you can't make mistakes. You can't project onto there anything incorrect. You see? Like Jehovah Tavavos gives a parable. He says, if you're in a room that you were never in, and it's totally dark, he says, you'll keep banging into the furniture because you don't know where the furniture is. He says, if you put on a flashlight, and you, just a small flashlight, you'll never bang in because you'll see exactly where the furniture is. But the same thing, when you see an idea clearly, you see, and it's real to you, so then you cannot make mistakes, okay? So therefore, if the thing is not clear in one of two ways. Either the idea is not clear to you, so if the idea is not clear to you, so then the emotion is going to operate. Or sometimes the emotion is so powerful that it closes off the idea, like in a moment of fear, like in a moment of fear, they could deny God. That's what happened. Many times they denied God. They were for certain desires. They, when the emotion took over, was very powerful. So they were able, the emotion took over and they denied God. Okay? But again, that's only where the information is not clear. Okay? Is that correct? Yes, it is possible that it's so clear that even in a difficult situation, you can, you will not block it out and the reality will stick to it. You see, that's a certain development. First, you see ideas, and you just live by it. Powerful emotions could overtake it, could overcome them. And you can see things in the emotional way in those situations. But you can't undo the power of the emotion also, so that even in the powerful situation, you can still see reality. That's part of the development. Okay? It's one of two. Either it's due to a non-clarity of the idea, or it's power of the emotion. If it's the non-clarity of the idea, then you have to study the idea and work through the idea. Okay? If it is the power of the emotion, so then you have to investigate the emotion and lower the level of the emotion. Depends where the problem lies, how you're going to deal with it. If the emotion is affecting you, then working on the idea will not help you. You have to work on the emotion. If it's the power of the emotion that's not allowing you to see the truth, it's blocking out the truth, or those situations where the emotion is awakened, then working on the clarity of the idea will not help you, then you must work on the emotion. Working on the idea is where the idea is not clear. You have to work it through and review it a certain amount of times to make it clear. But once it becomes clear and then it still doesn't work in certain situations, it doesn't work, then clarity of the emotion and why and how it is stopping you and then how to deal with it will help you see the truth. In our case where the miracle is occurring because the person is doing an act and then the miracle happens, there is another factor in the clarity, and that is the person that's performing the miracle. Okay? In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, you come into a room and you meet somebody, first time. Within a minute or two, you'll sense you feel comfortable with the person or you feel uncomfortable. Okay? What's happening is you sense immediately that the guy has a friendly guy and easy to talk to, or you sense he's the person looking down at you or has angry emotions. You might not define, you only feel the result. You don't necessarily recognize the cause. You feel the result. Of course, one unconscious picks up from the other unconscious. Okay? Is that clear? Right. If that is so, then the same thing when the person is performing the miracle, you see, if he has any ego attached to the miracle, it could be the slightest part, then the people could pick up on that ego thing, and that could help them blur the facts. See, that in itself could help them blur the facts. On the other hand, if he has no ego attached at all, you see, then they sense that too, and they could attach it to God. They could attach it to God, you see, because they don't sense anything from him. So therefore, because of that, they have the ability to attach it to reality and attach it to the true cause, namely God. Okay? So the question that we have to ask is, what if a person... We have to ask the question now, let's say a person like Moshe Eliyahu, that they have no ego at all attached to the miracle. Could the public now still not see the truth? Or is it that they have to see the truth? Once that happens, like, it's impossible for them not to see the truth. Somebody wants to say, they want to say that, look, by Har Sinai, the people didn't follow God. They just made certain errors. Yeah, but that was only after Har Sinai. But at the time of the miracle, everybody accepted Har Sinai. It was only afterwards that they didn't accept. In other words, we had a discussion that we said basically that we had a discussion about why miracles are weaker than wisdom. You see? We said miracles just change you for the moment, while wisdom changes you permanently. Okay? So therefore, we're not denying the weakness of a miracle, but we're asking, in other words, that afterwards, when you do the miracle, after the miracle, the next day, you could go back to your old ways. Okay? Now we had, that we showed, right? But so the thing is, but we're discussing now at the time of the miracle, when the miracle is happening, and the person has no ego, is it 100% sure that everybody that sees that miracle will accept that it's God? Or no, it's just that it's a higher probability. In other words, as long as you don't have the ego involved, so it's a higher probability that it's going to work. It's a better probability, but there's still no guarantee. But however, afterwards, the next day or the next week, yeah, miracles have short-term effect, not long-term effect. Chachma has long-term effect. Chachma is permanent. But however, miracles, it's just the immediate changes you over. Now the question is, what are you going to do with this knowledge? If you're going to work on it and make it into chachma, so then you'll develop and it'll become permanent. But if you don't do anything, it passes. The passing thing. You see? So therefore, we're not denying that miracles is short term. But however, we're saying what does it at the time that the miracle is happening. And the person thinks the Moshe after the miracle, way after Har Sinai, they started questioning God. That only shows that the result or the effects of a miracle are not long-term. That we discussed already, that it's not long-term. Our question is, at the time of the miracle, can a person, if the person that's performing the miracle does not have any ego involved, at the time of the miracle, can he totally deny that it comes from God? What I'm saying is, at the time of the miracle, okay, is it possible at the time of the miracle, when the miracle is happening, and the person has no ego attached to it, can a person say that it's not from God, but from the person? Okay? Any time after the miracle, it could be 1 minute after the miracle, then the person, it might have a very short-term effect. After the miracle, it's the after effect. I'm talking about during the time of the miracle. Can we find a case that a person during the time of the miracle denies that the miracle happened from God if it happened through Moshe or Eliyahu, who had no ego invested at all? There was no ego invested at all. I'd like to know, is that thing possible at the time of the miracle? I don't. If 1 minute after is not good anymore, but then it's an after effect. Now the question is, if we find a case where a person did not accept the miracle, that would be a proof that you could interpret a miracle incorrectly, even where the person has no ego. But the opposite you can never prove, because if every miracle worked, it could be that it just didn't happen. You see? Right. But so the question is, how would you go about proving one way or the other? You don't have such a case. The answer is, then you'd have to prove it based on human nature. You understand human nature and explain how human nature works, then you'd be able to explain how the phenomenon they could still see, even though it might never have happened in history, and we don't have a case, but however, it's possible that you could prove from human nature that it can happen, that a person could have, the person who the miracle is being performed through doesn't have an ego, and yet we could still attach it to the person himself. And we're discussing the possibility of it being Paro might be the case, that Paro did not accept the miracle at the time of the miracle. It is possible. But we're trying to see from the words the Chumash, if Para if we have some proof from the Pasuk that Para actually did not accept it at the time of the miracle. That's what we're trying to work out. The question is like this. If Para lived in a society where magic was rampant, and they really held some magic, or they knew it was sleight of hand, right? And here comes Moshe that does the miracle, so it's a little bigger, right? Yes, right? So therefore, Paro could definitely not believe it. But the thing is, it's not just a matter of quantity. The miracles were qualitatively different. They were very noticeable that they were different. And for Paro to say that it is similar, except better, that Moshe is a better magician than his magician, that would take a certain denial of reality. You would have to deny reality. The fact would definitely show that the miracle is a qualitative difference than the sleight of hand of his magician. Would definitely be that. But that was the whole test. That's why Paro was condemned, because he should have been able to see, but he hardened his heart. The question is, is he able to harden his heart during the time of the miracle, or no, he's only able to harden his heart immediately after the miracle stops. That's what we're trying to prove. In Shemot, Perek Zion, Pasuk Yudbeis, and Yudgimel, it says that every man of the Egyptians threw down their sticks and it became a snake, and the stick of Aaron swallowed their sticks. And that was a very big miracle, because Rashi says that it was the stick that did it, and it wasn't as a snake. So that was a very, very good miracle. And then in Pasuk Yud-Gimel it says, "Vayevzak le'Paro v'lo shama aleihem." Paro hardened his heart. At that very moment, he hardened his heart. So therefore, you see that even though the person does not have an ego. The person to whom the miracle is being performed does not have an ego. You have the ability to totally project onto that reality the idea that really the person is doing it, and not God. You still have the ability to. It's still not clear. In other words, there's still enough doubt. Enough darkness that when you look at it superficially, that even though the person doesn't have the ego and you sense that, you can still project onto the total situation that the power comes from the person and it's not a miracle of God. Right, we're discussing the point about that Moshe and Eliyahu were inherently on the level that they could perform miracles and there is no ego involved. Okay? Then Elisha and Eliyahu could double the amount of miracles that Eliyahu gave. Eliyahu says he couldn't do it. What does that mean? It means that Elisha is not on the level, which means that he has a certain amount of ego left over, which the public will pick up on. Then he says, no, if you're able to see this vision of the chariot, the horses of the chariot, so then you'll be able to do it. Question is, why is that? So I said, explain that if you could understand the knowledge of what is necessary to control the emotions, that knowledge, whatever that knowledge is, then you'll be able to control your emotions. Even though you can't get rid of the ego, you're not on the level of Moshe Eliyahu, but you will be able to control the ego that you wouldn't even project it, so that people will not see it, right? So therefore, people will not attach to Elisha any type of that he has the power to produce a miracle. But in other words, you could always project onto a person, even if he doesn't have it. You could project on Moshe too, to project on Eliyahu, anything. But it doesn't come from them, and you can't perform a miracle unless it doesn't come from you. So, Rabbi Jay said, there are two ways of that it doesn't come from you. Either inherently you don't have the ego, or you have the knowledge which is necessary to perform that type of miracle, and therefore you can cover, you have the ability through this knowledge to cover any type of ego, so you will not project that ego, so people can't see it from you, that you have any involvement in the miracle. The question that we'd like to discuss is, how does it work? How does it work? If there are two ways of controlling the emotions. One is simply through superego. Conscience will control the emotion, right? Then the second way is knowledge. Okay? We'd like to know how the knowledge works, that through knowledge you can control your emotions. Superego is a control over the emotion that we understand. That's a psychological phenomenon. But we want to understand the psychological phenomenon is when you see an idea, how that idea is able to control the emotion completely, that it doesn't even show up. Here, in other words, the public is reading your unconscious, okay? And here you are totally covering up. It's not to control yourself from an act, but you have the ability to cover up the total ego based on knowledge. It's a control where you're covering up the ego completely. The question is, how does that work? And with superego, many times it shows. With the superego, if it's controlled with the superego, you can't hide it. It's going to show up. But here we're saying with knowledge, it will not show up. So we're saying there's a difference. It's not just that there's two ways of controlling. It is two ways of controlling, but there's a difference in the way of controlling. The superego, the psychological superego, will control your emotions, but most of the times it will show up, or you could sense it in the person, even though it's covered up with the superego. But here we're saying that you could totally control it to such an extent that it will not show up into the public. The public won't even sense it, that there is any ego here. And he still has the ego, but it will not show up. So we'd like to know how that works. We're not denying that it's a control on emotion. In other words, knowledge can control an emotion. Here we're saying that the emotion will not show up and you will not sense it. In other words, let's say, for instance, you meet somebody that has a certain emotion that's covered up. You can sense it. There's ways of sensing it. It's there. It shows up somehow. We're saying that it's not going to show up to the public, even though he has that emotion. It's not going to show up in the public, and they won't even sense it. Now the question is, how does that work? What we want to say is that since it's unconscious, we're dealing with an unconscious thing. If it was conscious, he would be aware of the emotion. Then he could be, get something else, and it's not unconscious anymore. He says that then he's dealt with it. But however, there is an unconscious thing, but he can recognize how it manifests itself. Okay? He recognizes how it manifests itself, and therefore, once he sees how it shows up, then he can deal with that aspect of the emotion. In other words, there's two levels of understanding the emotion. One is I understand the nature of the unconscious. I bring it into the conscious level, you see, the emotion itself. And two is I see the way it manifests itself, but I don't have out the unconscious thing. The unconscious thing is still unconscious, but I see the way the unconscious manifests itself, and therefore, since I could see that, so then I could deal with that aspect and be able to. That it doesn't show via the knowledge of that aspect of how it shows up. With that knowledge, I could control the way it manifests itself. The question is that a perfection? And the answer is yes, because we say that perfection is knowledge. That is two types of knowledge. One is the knowledge of the unconscious itself, and one is the knowledge of how the unconscious works. How it manifests itself. In other words, let's say, for instance, you have a desire, a jealous person, right? So he wants to destroy something. He doesn't understand the nature of the jealousy, but he understands the idea that he wants to take away that which you have. So he sees that, and he understands that, and he doesn't, like a regular jealous person, wouldn't even think about that. He'll just take it away and he'll rationalize it, he'll work it out. But however, there's a certain level where you recognize, just on the activity level, that the activity is wrong. That's a level of perfection. And therefore, you could deal with the activity and see that it is irrational to do such a thing, even though you do not understand the unconscious or how the unconscious affects it and how it causes it to happen. We're saying that if the unconscious will show up and people will sense it, we're saying if you have the knowledge of how it manifests itself, how it shows up, even though you do not have knowledge of the unconscious, you see, that is enough for you to work on that area so that it should not manifest itself. And you could control it from that point. To clarify is that the difference between the superego that controls there is absolutely just controls the cover. Let's put it this way: the superego covers the unconscious, but you're still acting based on the unconscious. Still acting on it, and it comes out not in a open way. In other words, if you didn't have a superego and you're jealous of somebody, just go out and kill them. You see what I mean? But however, with the conscience, you might talk less than her about the guy. And it still comes out. The emotion is still there. It's operating. It comes out in a neurotic fashion. Okay? Not in a direct fashion. Okay? What we're saying is that if you understand the nature of the evil action, you understand the nature of the unconscious, what's causing it, but you don't see it. You don't see the unconscious clearly. You have knowledge of it. You have knowledge of how it works. What they have knowledge of how the ego works and how the ego is going to affect me and how the ego shows up. And how it formulates itself in my behavior, my body action, in all these areas, you see. So even though I don't have knowledge of the unconscious in the particular, to undo the unconscious itself, but I have enough knowledge of the unconscious in general, and also particular knowledge of how it manifests itself in the physical world, you see. So then I can deal with that aspect that it wouldn't even show up, even the way I operate, it will not show up at all to the public because of my knowledge of these desires, because of the way it manifests itself, the way the unconscious manifests itself. So therefore, I could control it. Yeah. In other words, every time you make a decision based on your mind, so then by your mind means that you understand the physical, you understand the physical phenomenon and how it works and why it's wrong or right to do, and the mind makes a decision on that, okay, based on the reality, not based on the undoing of the unconscious. You see, that's two different levels. Two different levels. One is living in reality, and one, both are living in reality. The one is that you don't have any conflict at all, and it will not show up because you don't have the emotion. You see, that's the higher level. I don't even have the emotion that I even have to deal with it. Let's say if a person doesn't have jealousy, or in this case, if a person doesn't have the ego at all, like most of the other, they don't have to deal with it. But therefore, it won't show up. But by Elisha, he had to deal with it. You see? But how he dealt with it is through the mind, not by undoing the unconscious, but through the mind he was able to deal on the realistic level, on the level of reality. He was able to deal at that level, not by undoing the cord totally. Okay, we're dealing with the on the tape where we talked about where Rabbi Chase spoke about Aderes Eliyahu. So he says there are two functions of clothing. One was to glorify man. One is just to cover the body. Okay? Yes. Okay. So the question is, what does it mean to glorify man? Okay. The answer is that a person identifies with his possession. He identifies himself with his possession. In other words, like this. When you buy a house, you don't just look at my physical needs, but you look at the style of the house. Represents you, who you are. The clothing that you wear. You don't go to the rack and say, I need clothing, cover me. But you buy clothing, of course, it has to fit in to a certain color scheme or to a certain look. In other words, like this is, let's say, for instance, you go to a black tie outfit, right? Now, okay, you don't want to be different, you're not going to come in jeans, so even Leo would wear a tux. But it's only because of the situation. Like, for instance, by Shlomo HaMelech, it says that even the color of the guards, what they wore, was for political reason. So it's a rational reason, every single thing is worked out, how people view it and how it affects them politically. And however, therefore, sometimes in a certain situation, you can't look different. I don't know if Elio would do that. Elio would probably wear the same old clothes and not affect them at all. But sometimes there's practical reasons, political reasons, why you have to dress certain ways. So that would be a rational reason. Okay, but most people, when they wear a tux, there's a certain view of themselves. Then when they dress in jeans, they have a different view of themselves. You know what I mean? Like I'm an easygoing guy, I'm cool. You know what I mean? And when you go and cut them sharp, you know what I mean? Like there's a certain. You watch your emotions, you'll see the clothing you wear affect the way you look at yourself and you identify with the clothing itself. Who you are is based on your clothing. At that moment, you could feel differently by the different styles that you wear, how you feel about yourself, and that when you're wearing that clothing. You see, so you identify, in general, you identify with your possessions, what type of possession you bought, not based on practicality, but most of the times it's based on a psychological view of yourself and who you are. So therefore, that's what possessions are. That's what it means, possessions. Glorifying it. It means it defines who I am. You see? Not so anyone had no meaningful role at all. Either like Shlomo with political reasons, or like Eliyahu was just to cover your body. Nothing more. So you got the only two reasons for clothing. Logical. Right, the question is that Rabbi Chen on another tape, in a Tzmius tape, said that clothing is represents philosophical shame, or brings about philosophical shame. Okay, philosophical shame is equal to what we're saying about Elisha, which is Visha Sayetza. In other words, based on the mind, I'm able to control my actions, and it affects the way I operate, but I still have the other desire. Therefore, I need the philosophical shame. Elio did not need philosophical shame. He just didn't have the need. He did not have any need to show his body. He had no need to identify with his clothing. He had no need for these things. It simply didn't bother him. He was a different person. That's the way we explain the difference between Eliyahu and Elisha. That's philosophical shame. Philosophical shame is equal to Elisha. Well, we explained to Elisha. So therefore, you consciously work based on your logical knowledge of what is real, and that in itself controls the unconscious desire to do the opposite, and you work from the conscious level. But however, Eliyahu did not wear the clothing for Kvitas Ayesha or for philosophical shame. He wore the clothing just to cover himself because he had no other, he didn't have the desire at all. It's all gone. The ego is gone. There's no self. Which means this is a result of the self, like you want to show your body or you want to, whatever the desire is that the clothing covers up. The question is like this, we were talking about Tzmius, so somebody asked a question about, that I mentioned on another tape, on a Tzmius tape, that there's something called philosophical shame. The question is, what is philosophical shame? Right. The thing is that when a person is born, he has a conscience. Okay? And the conscience is attached to the person that raises him. Whoever raises him, in effect. In other words, the person has the ability to be trained. By the way he is trained is that conscience, in other words, when the people that train him cause him to act in a certain way, that becomes part of his conscience, and he becomes trained that way. Okay? Now, it is possible to, through the world of study, to reroute the conscience from the way you were trained to rationale, and therefore you feel guilty when you don't follow your conscience. So therefore, now we want to say that Eliyahu and Moshe did not need the conscience at all. They were totally guided, totally, completely by Chochmah. Everybody else needs a conscience. But however, at a certain level, your conscience is subordinated not to the way you were raised, but it's subordinated to the world of ideas. And if you would go against the truth, the world of ideas as you see it, then you would feel guilty. The last question is why did Eliyahu use the cloak to split the sea, and Elisha used the cloak to make the sea come together? They waved the cloak. The question is why? Because the cloak represents that the physical is not important to me. There's no There's no it doesn't affect me. So therefore, the cloak represents that I'm on the level of performing miracles. You see, that the body has no meaning to me. Therefore, I use the cloak so that the it represents that. Therefore, I could perform miracles, but the body and everything about the body is not important to me, and therefore it will not show up in any attachment to the physical. So therefore, since I don't have any attachment to the physical, so therefore I could perform a miracle, and that's what the cloak, that's why they use the cloak, because the cloak represents that idea. The next thing that he dealt with was the, Rabbi Tate dealt with the monument of the dead, and he said, what is the monument of the dead? That the, that it shows that there is a difference in the nature of the soul. First, the soul is attached to the physical. Then when he dies, the physical is not here, so it shows there's a change in the physical. Okay? So therefore, since there's a change in the physical, so therefore you put up the monument. Now the soul is different. The soul is involved in the ideas, and it's not attached to the physical at all, because the physical has died. Only the soul is left. But by Moshe and Eliyahu, there was no monument. Nobody knows where they are. Doesn't mention it. So they didn't have a monument. So the question is why? Because by both of them, their involvement in the world of ideas, even when they were alive, was not affected by the physical. So therefore, there was no difference after they died. There was not a, they were not affected by the physical. So therefore, there is no monument by both Moshe and Eliyahu. Right, we're going back to the last discussion about the difference between the philosophical superego and the psychological superego, okay? Now, once you live a world of ideas, so then the superego becomes subordinate to the world of ideas, and you feel guilty, not the way your parents raised you, but what is irrational, okay? But however, by Elio and Moshe, you can't get rid of the superego, because that's part of, that's like, the way I understand it, it's like having a heart. I mean, you just can't get rid of it. Alright? But the only thing is, it doesn't have any function. By Moshe and Elio, there was no function there, because everything was guided by Chachma. So they didn't need they didn't need the superego. You see, they didn't need it. While Elisha did need it, you see. So, I mean, he was guided by Chachma, but every once in a while there was a part of him where he needed the superego, and he had to work it out with Chachma to deal with it. The question is what superego do they have, the philosophical or psychological? Everybody has a superego. But the question is, what causes you to become guilty? What causes you to feel shame or fear? In other words, what controls the superego? You're born with the superego. The first thing that the superego attaches to is the parents. And the parents make your superego. But however, a person on a true chachma, what controls the superego is not the parents anymore, but the world of ideas. So the superego is a component of the psyche of the human being. Everybody has it. The only thing is that by Moshe and by Eliyahu, it just didn't, just wasn't functioning. Because they were totally guided by Chachma. They didn't need, since they didn't have any, they had no self, they had no ego, so therefore there was nothing to take them away from the world of ideas, so therefore there was nothing to, they didn't need the superego at all. But it's not that you could cut it out, you can't cut the superego out, just that it didn't function anymore. By Moshe and Eliyahu, since they didn't have any attachment to the physical, So therefore, the superego had no need to operate. There was only the mind operating, that's it. In other words, there was no attachment to the physical, so they didn't need the superego to control their actions. You see, but why does the person go against the world of ideas? Because you're attached to the physical and you're drawn to the physical. By Moshe and Eliyahu, they were not attached to the physical at all. So since they weren't attached to the physical, so therefore the superego simply didn't operate. In other words, the superego only operates when there's a part of you that goes against the superego. In the case of Eliyahu, if there was a part of him that went against any type of rationale, then the superego would have been awakened. But since there was no component that was attached to the physical, there was no reason for the superego to be awakened. There couldn't be nothing awakened in the superego. So therefore, the superego was never awakened. It's not that he doesn't have it, but the superego is awakened when you go contrary to your training. If you're under the psychological influence, then you feel guilty when you go against what your mommy or daddy said. You see? But if you're influenced by the philosophical, so then you feel guilty when you go against the rational ideas. But that's when there is the desire to go against the superego, as the superego awakens. By Moshe and Eliyahu, they didn't have any attachment to the physical, so there was nothing to awaken the superego. But they didn't get rid of the superego, it just there was nothing to awaken it. Clothing to most people, to the philosophical, in other words, psychologically clothing is just I'm ashamed of my body. There's something where I'm trained to be ashamed of my body. There's something wrong with it. Philosophical shame, clothing represents the idea that this is the source of all my desires, so the superego feels guilty about, in other words, about these ideas that I'm attached to. So I try, what does the superego do? It tries to cover. So I cover that which I'm ashamed of. It represents the shame. By Eliyahu and Moshe, the clothing represented that it just doesn't exist. It's just a different thing that the body just plays no role at all. There is no role there. Well, we're going back to the monument or the gravestone that Moshe and Eliyahu didn't need it because they were totally attached to the world of ideas in this world, and when they died, there was no change in the physical. Question is, by Moshe it says that Moshe has to know about God's essence, him, and then God says, Adam, a person can't know me and be alive, only if he dies. You see, there is a change, even in Moshe, and definitely in Eliyahu, there is a change. So the question is, what does it mean there is no change? I don't know if I could answer this completely, but all I could say is that insofar as the drive, since they did not have an ego, all their energy was attached to the world of ideas, that's what the monument means. But however, the fact is that they still had a physical body seems to be that there's something else left from what we said. I don't know what that other thing left is. Okay. In the final steps of the tape, Rabbi Chait makes a distinction between Moshe and the revelation of the divine, public revelation to the divine inspiration, and Abraham didn't need this because it was all personal revelation. His relationship to God was only personal, and it didn't deal with the public, any type of public revelation. Abraham's relationship to the public was like a preacher, like a rabbi that talks to the public and has discussions with them, but it wasn't any revelation from God himself, okay? Which means that the essence
of this animamet, okay, this fundamental principle is that it's God that you must understand God, how God reveals himself to the public, and the person, the vehicle of how he reveals himself, that it is through a person, that person, the nature of that person that is being revealed, that is the fundamental principle, okay? So that we don't understand, okay? Why? Because I could understand if he's telling me that the highest level of a human being is, the highest level of a human being is, where there is no attachment to the physical, and that non-attachment to the physical is the level I should strive for and the direction I could go, even though the Torah testifies that nobody could make it, but at least I understand the direction in which I have to go, so that, because that, for how I should relate to God, or how God relates, or who God relates to, so therefore that becomes an essential thing. But because of the, but in this case you're telling me that it's the weakness of the public that therefore you need to know Moshe's level. It's because of the weakness of the public. What is the public? The public is not thinkers. Like, let's say Rabbi Akiva was there. Rabbi Akiva wouldn't need this, there wouldn't be any problem, but even though he's not on the level of prophecy, Rabbi Akiva, but he has the knowledge of that you can't have anything physical about God. So let's say he was at the revelation, a person like Rabbi Akiva. Aaron was also at the revelation. Aaron was at a level of prophecy. Avram had prophecy, so he knew that God was not physical. He would not make any mistake from God's revelation. If God reveals himself through Moshe, we would not make any mistakes. The problem is that the weakness of the public, so because of the weakness of the public, so I need a certain method to overcome the weakness of the public. So because of that, I need a certain a level of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now that, to me, is not an essential fundamental. The essential fundamental is how God, who God is, or how God relates to us. But because of the weakness of the public, in other words, what Rabbi Chait is saying is that the essence, and really that's what the fundamental is saying, that the essence is who Moshe is. But what it comes out, since you're making a distinction between Moshe and Avram, that I have to know this, so then you're saying the essence is the weakness of the public, therefore I need a Moshe because of the weakness of the public. That is not an essential factor. You see? The essential factor must be something about Moshe himself. So therefore it should make, why is that a necessity to tell me the weakness of the public, that it comes through the weakness of the public that I see this fundamental? It should be essentially in Moshe himself that teaches me something in how you must be to relate to God. But when Rabbi Chait made the distinction between Avram and Moshe, so he's saying no, that this is it's not necessary for Avram to know this life. Avram should also know it, because he should know that's a higher level. Maybe Avram did know it, but he just didn't reach that level. But he knew that was the direction he should go for. But Rabbi Chait says it wasn't necessary to Avram. If it's not necessary to Avram, then it only has to do with the relationship to the public. Now, she's telling me because of the weakness of the public, I have to do something to work it out for him. I mean, that, I don't see why that's one of the essentials. There was another question asked, side point, but the question is, what is the difference between, he said, the difference between Moshe and Eliyahu is a qualitative difference, right? The question is, what is the quality? What is the quality? Okay? So the thing is, we wanted to say, like, let's say in centigrade, there's zero. Zero is when you get this freezing, right? And the difference, the step from 1 degree to zero is that it affects things even though it's one step, one degree, there is a qualitative change in the air and how it relates to the, like, let's say, liquid. In other words, at 1 degree centigrade, so then it's, then there is still, in other words, it is still not a qualitative difference. It's still cold, the lowest cold that you could get before things start freezing. So therefore, there is a qualitative difference. We can see how it affects the physical. Well, for instance, in Avodah Zarah, there's two types of Avodah Zarah. There was the Jewish type and the foreign type. The Jewish type was where you related to God, but you related to God incorrectly. Now, Achav's father was like the lowest level of relating to the Jewish God. He related to the God, but like God was totally physical. Like, you know, but he was relating to that God totally incorrectly. The next step is Achav, where he relates to the object itself. The object itself is God. You see, it's physical, like a piece of wood. In other words, there's one where I look at God and I see him physical. I mean, he's practically a physical thing, but I'm still looking at that God. You see? But, so therefore, it goes step by step, and the very last change is a qualitative change. Okay? Now, Eliyahu was able to live for 40 days without eating, right? Okay. But, however, he still had some attachment to the physical. Psychologically, he had some attachment to the physical. Therefore, when God related to him, that physical had to show up. So, therefore, because of his attachment, so he had to have some food before the 40 days. Like, for instance, they said they could send people up out of space with pills. They'll have all the pills, they'll be totally physically okay. But psychologically, they're not eating. They go crazy because they're not eating psychologically. They have to chew. They have to have something psychologically. You understand? So the same thing is that he still was some psychological part of him was attached to the physical, but at the lowest level, which is closest to the qualitative change, you see? So therefore, they already have similarities, right? In other words, just like we said, the lowest level of Avodah Zarah that's relating to God, and changing that, moving that from that a piece of wood is God, looks like there's a lot of similarities already, but it is a qualitative change, okay? Because you're dealing with a different object, you see. So the same thing here, the quantity is so low that there's a lot of similarities. Okay? So the question is, but since he has that level of attachment, could that, even though it's the smallest level of attachment, why doesn't that affect how people look at miracles? I mean, it could also, since he has some attachment to the physical, the question is, could that in any way affect people, how they look at the miracle? And Rabbi Chaik wanted to make a difference between the creation of the system and getting people to accept an existing system. So he wanted to make that distinction.